At long last, rain. The weather radar was almost hallucinogenic this morning. Heavy rain closed down the Grand River and Okemos Road intersection for a while this morning. There were other traffic hang-ups, but hopefully we are back to normal. Coming up this hour on Current State, author Mo Gerhart, who was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy at the age of 8, talks about his experience with that crippling disease. His book is called Perspectives from an Electric Chair. And MSU student Steve Price joins us. If you're a viewer of America's Got Talent, you may have caught Steve last week on the show. He demonstrated just a mind-blowing contraption on national TV. It's this extraordinary Rube Goldberg-type device. And Steve Price joins us later this hour to talk about this unique skill that he has. That's all coming up. At the top of the program today, in 2 weeks, Michigan legislators will begin hearings on how to improve teacher evaluations in our state. They'll consider a new plan submitted recently by the Michigan Council on Educator Effectiveness. That's an independent body created by Governor Rick Snyder in the legislature 2 years ago after the passage of teacher tenure reform here in Michigan. One of the council's main recommendations is that, beginning in 2 years, half of a teacher's evaluation be based on classroom practices and half on student growth based on test scores. Key members of the MCEE have been getting lots of questions and feedback about their plan. Yesterday, the Detroit Free Press hosted a live web chat with some of those members. We thought it was a pretty good opportunity to check in on the process. And joining us to do that is David Venzel, the principal of Jefferson High School in Monroe, Michigan. Mr. Venzel was also a voting member of the MCEE that studied the issue and wrote this plan. David Venzel, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tell us more about this plan to base half of a teacher's evaluation on classroom practice and the other half on student growth. I take it the student growth portion is generating more discussion than the classroom practice?
You know, I would say it's probably equal, and depending on what group of educators you speak with, I know there's a little bit of anxiousness and trepidation on those that are going to be affected by this. But really, we've spent the last 18 months as a council trying to come up with recommendations that really will help all of us improve our practice, and by doing that, we will help students really achieve at a higher level. So the recommendations affect not only the classroom teachers, but also administrators like myself. So I think they're really equal. And what's going to happen is when we get to the 2015-16 school year, when hopefully there's full implementation of the recommendations, that's when 50% of a teacher's and an administrator's evaluation will be based on student growth.
And is it clear, or is it even becoming clear, how that student growth would be measured?
Well, I think it's becoming clear, and I really think it'll be a work in progress over the next couple of years. And one of the recommendations that we made was that because to follow the letter of the law, the actual student growth portion was should take effect this year with the 13-14 school year. In the original writing of the law, it said that the first year, which would be this year, student growth would count for 25% of a teacher's evaluation. And then next year, 14-15, it would count 40%. And finally, in 15-16 school year, when it's fully implemented, it would count half of the evaluation. So I think one of our recommendations is that if districts, there are some districts that are ahead of the game on this and that are ready, and they've worked in collaboration with their teacher groups and with their administrative groups, and they feel confident in what they're using to measure student growth. For those districts, they can begin using student growth in full scale this year. But for those that aren't at that point, then one of the recommendations of the council would be that it may behoove them to pilot student growth for the next couple of years so they can figure it out.
Would it use standardized tests?
A portion would be standardized tests, and you know, part of what we studied also was the concept of value-added modeling, where you use standardized tests and you really try to determine what influence and what input did a teacher have as far as a student's growth, and you use statistical models to try to break that down. At this point in time for the state of Michigan, the only tests that really will help us with that are the MEAP tests in reading and mathematics in grades 4 through 8. at the high school level, which I'm at, the only standardized test that we're using right now is the Michigan Merit Exam, which is administered in the 11th grade school year, and a portion of that Michigan Merit Exam includes the ACT. We're not in a position to use standardized tests across the board K-12 yet, but hopefully by the 15-16 school year, there will be more of those types of assessments in place so that we can do that. But part of the evaluation tools used to measure student growth will include other forms, which can be developed at the district level.
And I see a teacher would be dismissed after 2 years of an ineffective rating. How is the reception to that been, and how does that differ from the kind of system that we have now?
Well, and you got to remember that I'll paraphrase our vision, but our vision is really to develop a system that really focuses on improvement, and in no way, shape, or form do we want it to be punitive. So we want a system that's going to help us all get better. The original writing of the law called for four categories of teacher evaluation, with the top category being highly effective, and then effective, minimally effective, and ineffective. And our recommendation is to limit that to three categories, with the top category being professional, the second category being provisional, and then the third category being ineffective. And if a teacher is ranked in the ineffective category for a period of time, like you said, for 2 years, then it is major cause for concern. But the responsibility for administrators like myself is to really try to help that teacher get on track and try to improve their practice. And one of the reasons that we felt strongly with three categories, with the top category being professional, is that highly effective with four categories makes it seem as if that's it. You know, if you're there, you can't get any better. And with professional as a category, we fully expect that the teacher in the professional category is going to set up a game plan, and part of the recommendations are that at the end of the school year, when you give your final summative evaluation to the teacher, regardless of whether or not he or she lands in the professional category, that you establish goals for the coming year, for the upcoming year. And so we're always trying to help teachers get better, and also to help principals get better.
But what has the MEA and the American Federation of Teachers, for example, what have they had to say about this dismissal option after 2 years of an ineffective rating? Are they actively resisting it? I mean, they played some kind of role in the process coming up with the plan, right?
Yes, and you know, I think it's probably a question better to ask them, but I do think that they seem to be receptive to the three categories versus the four categories. I think there is some concern that they want to ensure a process where there's fairness across the board, and that the tools that we use, the observation tools, and then the tools that we use as far as measuring student growth are fair, and that they're transparent, and that they're reliable, and that they're valid, so that teachers get a fair shake.
But David, are they actively resisting this dismissal after 2 years of ineffective? Are they actively resisting that, or are they on board with that?
No, I think they're on board with it.
Okay. What a person who pays very close attention to this told me yesterday that all the recommendations together constitute a sea change in teacher evaluation. Do you agree?
I would agree.
And why? How does it so dramatically contrast with the system that we've had up until this point?
Well, for one thing, under the old system, at least for the majority of districts, a teacher was evaluated probably every 3 years, and it depended on the contract that was in place with the particular teaching group. Now, with the new law, that teachers are going to be evaluated every year, and so it gives us all a chance to kind of review and look at our practice and say, how can we get better at it? And there's going to be we're going to have to measure student growth, and so I think there's going to be a more of an emphasis on making sure that every student that enters the classroom of a teacher is going to have the focus of that teacher. So I think it's just going to be more intensive, and I think that if we can hold to our mission and our vision, that the whole purpose of this law is to help us all get better as educators so that students can achieve at a higher level, then we'll be okay with it. But I do think there's going to be some growing pains as we try to figure out how we're going to use student growth and what tools we're going to use to measure student growth. There's going to be some growing pains as we determine what observation tools that we're going to put in place. Now, we did pilot four observation tools, and you know, once this goes to the legislature, and hopefully they'll support our recommendations, then the state will put out an RFP for one of those four to be the state-recommended tool for observations.
We're talking with David Venzel about changing Michigan teacher evaluations here in the state. I know the legislature doesn't begin hearings on this for two more weeks, but have you heard from any of the education committee members, Senator Pavlow, or anyone else about the plan?
We did have an opportunity to meet with Senator Pavlov and Majority Leader Richerville before the final report came out, just to give them an update. And I will tell you that they have been supportive for the entire process, and Senator Pavlov has been very supportive of our work, and we really had to ask for an extension because I think the original timeline wanted it done at a much quicker pace, I think within a full year, and it took us over 18 months to complete our work. He was very supportive of that, and I'm hopeful that they're going to accept our recommendations.
I'm curious how you think politics may impact your plan. Do you anticipate a particular response from Democrats in the legislature?
No, I don't think so. I think there should be bipartisan support on this kind of an issue.
I know your group recommended against tying pay incentives to performance, and that one proposal in the legislature would do just that. Why, in your view, is tying bonuses to high performance a poor idea?
I think it is. I think it is.
Why?
I think it's very complicated in how we evaluate teachers in public school settings, and it's sometimes very difficult to measure. And I'll use my high school building as an example. We need to establish a culture where all of our professionals in this building are collegial and they want to help each other, not a situation where they're in competition on who's going to get a bonus based on test scores or who's going to get a bonus based on having a professional rating versus a provisional rating. Or, you know, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to sustain that kind of work. And we want veteran teachers who are really extremely effective in the classroom, sharing their knowledge with those that are entering the profession. So we want the in my math department, I want my 20-year teachers helping out my first-year teachers and my second-year teachers so that they can really be effective.
A related issue, David, is funding for training people to do these assessments. How important is that?
It's essential. It's essential, and the training has to come from whatever vendor that you're going to use. So, if through the RFP process selects one of the vendors, and they're going to, what our recommendation is that they provide funding now to complete the training, and the training would be administered by the vendor, so that we know exactly what the purpose of their observation tool is, and that everybody's on the same page as far as understanding the language that is used. And then districts would have the opportunity to choose one of the other three that were part of the pilot, and then the recommendation would be that the state would fund up to the point of the funding for the one that was selected by the state. So we think it's just absolutely essential that there's training. And training not only for the people that are going to be doing the observations, but training for the teachers are going to be on the receiving end of the observations.
David Venzel is the principal of Jefferson High School in Monroe, Michigan. Mr. Venzel was also a voting member of the Michigan Council on Educator Effectiveness that studied how to strengthen teacher evaluations in our state. David Venzel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Labor Day is next Monday, and with it, the annual Muscular Dystrophy Telethon. Over the years, hundreds of millions of dollars have been raised for research to help people like our next guest, Mo Gerhart. Gerhart is the author of Perspective from an Electric Chair. The book chronicles his childhood, his diagnosis at the age of 8, and how he's coped with the disease and other physical challenges. He talked about his life and his book with Current State's Scott Pohl.
At birth, there were no signs of anything different, but growing up as a young kid, I remember actually specifically in kindergarten when everyone would be sitting on the floor, I would be the last one to be able to get up. It took me a little bit extra time, and we lived in a two-story house, and going upstairs, I wasn't able to alternate my feet. I'd have to do one at a time and sort of push off my knees. So there were some signs. I remember playing youth soccer and not being able to kick the ball as hard as my teammates. So there were little things, you know, as far as growing up was concerned, but nothing as far as hand-eye coordination or anything as far as like speaking or walking, those stages all came across normal. But it was just little things here and there that were sort of the beginning initial signs that something just wasn't normal. And that's why my parents sort of did take a couple extra steps and had some tests run and had me go through with a couple of physical therapists until they were able to make that definitive diagnosis based off of a muscle biopsy that I had when I was 8 years old.
So at the age of 8, when you get a diagnosis like that, what's next in terms of your treatment, the way your parents help you function? What goes on at the age of 8 when this happens?
It's interesting. When I think back on it, I honestly do not recall one specific day where I was told that I had muscular dystrophy or one specific doctor's appointment. In reality, it was something that I had been living with my whole life. So it wasn't as if something all of a sudden changed. It was still a normal everyday occurrence to me. Now, obviously, for my parents, that was a different story. You know, when they did receive that diagnosis, I think for any parent, that's going to be, you know, a blow and a big time shock. And I think they could probably tell you today, specifically that day that they were told where they were, what they were doing. Whereas for me, it was just the same old. I was still just going on and continuing with my everyday occurrences. But I do remember in elementary school, you know, a few different physical occurrences where to me, all of a sudden, it did become more of a reality where I was able to see my classmates doing some things that all of a sudden physically I knew I wasn't able to do. And all of a sudden, I knew why I wasn't able to do it either.
When did you start using a wheelchair?
I was actually fully walking up until through my junior year in high school. I had started to use a wheelchair on an intermediate basis, specifically more so during the winter months, especially growing up in Traverse City where the winters are long times and quite harsh at times. It's interesting that at that point, our high school, you still had to go outdoors to get to class to class. And so during those winter months, I would use a wheelchair outside to get from my classes just for safety reasons. And then it was actually on the night of my best friend's birthday, when I got back home late that night, May 23rd of 1995, I actually had a bad fall at my house and fractured my femur. I had a spiral fracture in my femur where it cracked in three different places. And after that and the atrophy from that rehab, I've used a wheelchair on a full-time basis ever since. It was one of those things, in order for me to have the most independence, it was determined that I would go right to a power wheelchair. Muscular dystrophy, it affects all your muscles, so that would be arm muscles included. So really using a manual or a push chair wouldn't allow me to get to point A to point B. So I went right to an electric chair right away.
All right, I want to ask you one last question about the challenges you face before we move on to how you deal with all of this. You've been involved in a bus accident. You've had multiple bone fractures. You've lost the vision in your right eye. You've really been up against it physically. And can you tell me a little bit more about functioning in the world that the rest of us function in when you have a wheelchair necessity, you've got a vision issue? Tell me more about getting around and functioning from day to day.
There definitely have been their challenges, as you mentioned. Some of those other things that have occurred have been nothing to do with my muscular dystrophy at all. So one thing I definitely do try to remember, and it's actually a saying I sort of created for myself, is that it's not the diagnosis that determines your outcome. So we're able to make a lot of choices in our life. What I've also found, I've been able to meet a lot of great people because of my disability and been able to you know, travel to different places and speak to a lot of different groups. And what I've found is in this world is no matter how bad you have it unfortunately, there's also somebody else out there that has it worse off than you do. So we're all blessed with things, and I'm fortunate enough where my mind is not affected by my disability, so I've been able to go on and receive a great education and to be able to utilize that in my work every day. And I'm very fortunate that I'm able to communicate with people, you know, how I feel and my day-to-day interactions. So I'm blessed with that. And honestly, that's what I think gets me through some of those challenges that I do face, because sure, that there are those down days. I think that's just human nature. And I'd be lying if I said that there weren't those days where those challenges impacted me greater than others. But as I've mentioned, I have a great support system. My family throughout my whole life has been very instrumental in all of my achievements. And I know I wouldn't have been able to achieve a lot of the success that I have without their support. And same thing with my friends. From a young age, I think being different is not something that anyone wants. And I can honestly say that I don't ever feel as if I was bullied growing up. And that's a testament to my friends and my peers.
Well, here's where we're going to shift into talking about your achievements, which include, you mentioned your day-to-day work. You work here at MSU after getting bachelor's and master's degrees here at Michigan State University. So, Mo Gerhart, tell us about the kind of work you do here on campus.
Yeah, I currently work with the College of Natural Sciences. I'm an academic advisor. Primarily, my main sort of cohort of students are the pre-professional students on campus, which would range anywhere from your pre-med, pre-dental, basically all of your pre-health career type students. Those are going to be the main focus that I work with. But then I have a few other hats, too, that are underneath sort of my supervision. And I work with students in the natural sciences that are the NatSci No Pref. So that would primarily be your freshman and sophomore students in the sciences that don't know specifically which major they're looking for in the sciences, but they know they want to go somewhere in the sciences. Then I also am the student athlete liaison for the natural sciences. So any varsity athlete on campus that is a natural science major, I help work with them to coordinate to make sure they maintain all their eligibility components. And then I've also recently been added on with through the Honors College, working with students in the natural sciences that are the Honors College students.
You mentioned athletics, Mo, and some of our listeners might recognize your name and your voice from the radio broadcasts of the MSU women's basketball games. You've been the analyst on the radio broadcasts. Tell us about getting involved with athletics at MSU, both in that way, and also I know you've done some competing in athletics, wheelchair athletics over the years. So athletics has been a big part of your life.
It has been. My family has been very athletic. My dad was a high school varsity baseball coach in Traverse City, also run the summer youth leagues. He also started the volleyball program in Traverse City. My brother was a great high school athlete, so I followed him as he was going through his career, and my mom was also very athletic. You could say it almost was part of my culture growing up, and it was something I never wanted to give up. So actually, when I started here at Michigan State in the fall of 1996 as a freshman, I was able to be put in contact with, at that point in time, the Sports Information Office, which is now Sports Communications, but was able to really start with them. And that's what really started my career with MSU athletics, being able to, whether it was keep stats or work in the press box, game day management, had a lot of different responsibilities. But the first sport that I really got put into with through the Sports Information Office was women's basketball. So I was courtside right from my freshman year. Really, from that point forward, women's basketball was something that I became very passionate about. When Susie Merchant was named head coach for MSU's women's team, I was fortunate in that I had a personal connection with Susie. And so I had gone to her and actually talked to her about a vision that I had for the radio broadcast. At that point in time, they only had a one-man crew. So what I did is I took a DVD of one of their games and dubbed my voice on top of that, and took that to Susie and really proposed the idea as far as being able to make it a two-man team. And she then took that to Will Thiemann with the Spartan Sports Network, and he liked the job that I had done. So he had me do a few more voice tests and a couple other interviews. And sure enough, they actually then offered me the position, and I just completed this last year, my fourth year doing that. And it's something that I love doing. It really keeps me involved here with MSU Athletics, and I would love for it to be able to even expand and hopefully even more opportunities develop from it.
Well, Mo, we're here to talk about your book, and we haven't talked about it at all yet. So I want to ask you to talk about your approach to writing this book, who your intended audience is. Do you intend this book for other wheelchair users, people who don't use wheelchairs? What was your intent in writing your book, Perspective from an Electric Chair?
In all honesty, I wanted my audience to be everyone. When I was in the brainstorm process, I thought about that. I tried to think, was this going to be something for young kids? Was it going to be something for adults? Was it going to be something for those with disabilities or without disabilities? And honestly, I felt the biggest impact was going to be to not try to frame it in that sense. It's actually been something that I've been able to go and do a lot of different discussions. And the youngest audience that I've talked with was actually a classroom of kindergarten students. And I have to be honest, that's probably the most nervous I've ever been with any group where I've gone and talked to were those kindergarten students. But it was still lots of fun. And obviously, it just made it real simple and broke it down just as far as differences. We can still all be friends. So just making it real simple and basic. But then I've also talked all the way up to senior citizens. Probably the most common group that I've been asked to come and communicate with has been high school students. They're very curious. They want to know about differences. And at the same time, they also realize that they're going to be out in that work world real soon, whether that be through college or whatever their next step is going to be. And they want to experience those different cultures or those different races, different disabilities. And that's where I think I've been able to have a really large impact in telling them sort of my story, but also my high school experiences and how those positive experiences have helped me really reach the fields that I have today.
Life is challenging, but you've forged a life that's rewarding and fun.
You have to have fun in life, and you have to be able to laugh at lots of things, too, at your mistakes, at your challenges, because if you don't, I mean, it can eat you up real quickly.
The book is Perspective from an Electric Chair. Mo Gerhart, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Scott. It's a honor, and anything here with Michigan State, you know I'm always sure to bring out that Spartan pride, so thanks for having me today.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Water attracted the early settlers of Detroit, and water fueled its growth. Now, it's an important asset to the city's recovery. Join Current State over these next 5 weeks as our Tuesday Night Environmental segment will explore Detroit's waterfront, challenges and opportunities through our series, Detroit's Water Renaissance. This series is produced by Current State and Great Lakes Echo with support from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. We kick off our series by going back to the days before industrialization, when the city of Detroit was a maze of fresh waterways. In 1702, Antoine de la Motte Cadillac sent Louis XIV a letter from the New World. In it, he described Detroit as a country so temperate, so fertile, and so beautiful that it may justly be called the earthly paradise of North America. Current State's Emmanuel Berry has more on the disappearing waters that once flowed through the Eden that was Detroit.
Today, most people would not consider Detroit to be the paradise of North America, but 300 years ago, it was home to a wide variety of plants and animals and was full of what Cadillac called sweet water. Water like the Savoyard, Connor, and May Creeks. But these waterways and several others seem to have disappeared.
Do you know how a question nags at you and nags at you?
That's Sean Nethercott, founder and executive director of Matrix Theater Company, and an expert on what she calls ghost waters, waters that were covered for the sake of human advancement. Researching historical waterways was not always a hobby for Sean. She was raised in a desert, so when she moved to Michigan...
Water, water everywhere, lakes, ponds, streams, marshes. It's a very complex watery environment. And then you come down to the city, no marshes, no streams, no lakes, no ponds. And I was like, all right, where did it go?
Sean discovered that the water went under roads, buildings, and grates. When the Erie Canal opened and Detroit's population started to boom, many of the creeks in the city were turned into open sewer systems. Diseases broke out, and the waterways were encased in pipes. Sean has attempted to reintroduce Detroiters to their watery past through projects at her community-based theater, Matrix. She also gives tours, highlighting where the haunted waters continue to make their presence known.
Now, where we're down here, we're right close to Joe Louis Arena. And I'm going to turn and go down onto Atwater. And then we're going to stop and I'm going to show you where the Savoyard River comes out.
Behind Cobo Center, 14 rusted grates obscure the Detroit River walk path. We stand over them and look down through the opening to the swirling water below.
This is actually where the outfall of the Savoyard River. And if you can see, it's what, about 20 feet wide.
Yeah.
When it was flowing, it was navigable. You could take boats on it. You can see, we're seeing right down to water here. Right down here, see? Straight down, that's water.
The hints left by the city's ghost waters go unnoticed by most. But there's a movement in Detroit and in cities across the country to liberate or daylight the lost waterways. Elmwood Cemetery, located on the east side of Detroit, is where Bloody Run is ironically unburied. In the mid-1700s, there was a battle along the creek between Chief Pontiac's men and the British.
And Chief Pontiac won the battle, and legend has it that British blood flowed through the creek, and thus the naming of Bloody Run Creek.
Virginia Stannard of the University of Detroit Mercy is a director of urban design at the Detroit Collaborative Design Center. She's standing next to me before the nearly half mile of Bloody Run Creek that is still visible. Bloody Run meanders its way down from I-94, weaving 3 miles through Detroit's east side before emptying into the Detroit River. The majority of the creek was covered after a massive cholera outbreak in the 1880s. Stannard says the center is planning a greenway development project that focuses on daylighting the large portion of the creek that's still covered.
Elmwood Cemetery here is this hidden gem, if you can imagine this kind of system, but expanded. And this kind of landscape that would weave through the Lower East Side of Detroit, I think it could be a really spectacular asset.
Imagine it? I cannot. The area is lush and green, and although the water in the creek is shallow, it's clear. So it's hard for me to envision shire-like pastures overtaking the industrial landscape of Detroit. But that's the plan. The 3,000-acre greenway project includes space for recreational activities. The development also incorporates food production, research, green energy initiatives, along with areas for new businesses and festival grounds. The uncovered creek could help with sewage overflows as well.
The system that we have today is called a combined sewer system, and so we are combining both stormwater and sanitary water, and that can produce a real heavy load on our sewer systems.
The result is overflows, which Stannard says pollute water ecosystems.
We can deal with a lot of the stormwater on the east side through the creek system, and we can really focus our sewer system on just handling the sanitary water.
Another benefit to daylighting streams, says Melissa Domanski, director of the Sierra Club's Great Lakes program, is that people will be reminded of their role in their local ecosystems.
As much as we often talk about the ecosystem this, the ecosystem that, we are the ecosystem too, and we impact it. And so in this case where we had local rivers and streams that were running to the Detroit River that we enclosed in pipes, we did that. We impacted the watershed.
And it will take time to reverse our impact. The Greenway will require years to plan and build. Broader funds for the project haven't yet been found, but developers are hoping to start a pilot daylighting development near Detroit's Eastern Market. Sean Nethercott of Matrix Theater says she'd like to see more daylighting projects so that Detroiters are no longer haunted by their waterways.
Water always wins. The water is still remembering us, even if we're not remembering it.
For Current State and Great Lakes Echo, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
This story was produced by Current State and Great Lakes Echo with support from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Our stories on Detroit's water renaissance continue next Tuesday with a look at the 1 mile of the Detroit River's shoreline that is not hardened by concrete and steel. Now let's take a closer look at Detroit's current environmental issues. This summer, a coalition of city organizations released the Detroit Environmental Agenda. The two-year project addresses improving quality of life by improving the environment. Guy Williams is president of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice. He joins us to discuss the report his organization helped to compile. Thanks for joining us, Guy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're welcome.
Explain how this report came to be, exactly.
Well, for me, who's been working on these issues for about 20 years, it's a great story. About 2 years ago, as part of the citywide planning for the future of Detroit, there was an environmental summit. About 200 citizens attended, and as you might imagine, at an all-day session like that, you come up with a lot of great ideas and promising themes that can't be followed through in one day. So Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice and our partner organizations decided we would work together to follow up on these recommendations and pull together the first of its kind. It's a report that basically summarizes all of the environmental issues in the city and recommendations for how to improve those conditions and what's at stake around that.
We have a lot of listeners here in mid-Michigan listening to us right now. Explain to them, how is the quality of life for Detroiters most noticeably linked to their environment? This segment we just heard was all about the water. How is the quality of life most notably linked to the environment in Detroit right now?
I would say of all the dynamics, there's kind of a close tie between air quality and how we can reutilize the land in the city. I mean, we have an industrial history here, of course, and a lot of facilities that are no longer functioning, and they've left us a legacy of contaminated land. And we also have an ongoing high level of air pollution of different types, which has had a tremendous impact on the health of people living here. We have high rates of asthma and other respiratory diseases. We have high rates of cancer in certain hot spots. And we also have the highest level, actually twice as high as the state average, is the level of elevated lead poisoning in children.
Mm. Well, your concerns about water are conspicuously absent in that. Does the quality of water in the Detroit area, is it less of a concern then? It sounds like it.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, we're obviously in a place that people do not rely on well water for drinking, which is not the case in lots of other areas of the state. So groundwater protection is, I would say, a lower echelon issue. But in terms of the surface water, we've also had about 20 billion gallons of raw sewage go into the Detroit River this year. So our sewer system is taxed by any kind of heavy storms like we have this morning.
Mm-hmm.
We can be pretty sure that the system overflowed today.
What do you consider the single most pressing environmental issue facing the city?
You know, it's just really hard to single out one thing, but I think I tend to look at it in terms of what could we get the best benefit to people the most easily, and that would be the air quality. I feel like that's something we have the technology and the policy means to address quickly, and that would alleviate a lot of the intense health suffering that's going on. Things like clean energy policy, reducing our reliance on diesels and some of the combustion sources that we have in the city. We have the nation's largest municipal waste incinerator here. We have several manufacturing facilities which may all be in compliance in and of their own right. However, right now, the regulatory structures don't allow for taking into consideration how those emissions overlap. So particularly in areas like Southwest Detroit, where you have the incinerators that burn the sludge from the wastewater treatment, You have the Marathon Refinery. You have steel factories. You have auto manufacturing. All of these things contribute to a high burden of air quality impacts that truly we believe are making people sick.
Who takes the lead, Guy, on changing this landscape, though? Is it the state legislature? Is it the DEQ? Is it organizations like yours in the city of Detroit? What's the best way to start that process?
Well, the whole reason behind our Detroit environmental agenda is we feel that the public needs to be better informed overall of what's going on and what the choices are, and that energy should work its way up through our elected officials and to the policymakers. So there's a coalition that has been working with Department of Environmental Quality on metrics and how to make improvements on some of these same issues that you see in the report. We're hoping that the agency would take a look at what you call cumulative impacts, which is the overlapping of the pollution sources I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We also hope that the legislature would, in their conversations about how to allocate funding in the state's budget, would consider this really important. I mean, I think people may not understand that to the extent that we really step up and become front of the pack nationally on environmental issues, we'll also have a benefit to our economy. I mean, it's gonna have the impact of making this a more attractive region to come to. It'll simplify the regulatory structure so businesses know what they need to do when they're investing in the state and in Southeast Michigan. There's a lot of upside potential to investing in the environmental scenarios.
But you see the spark, the trigger here, as being generated locally in the city of Detroit?
Yes, absolutely.
With Detroit's current economic situation, many would suggest that the environment can't be at the top of the priority list. There seems to be an idea that fixing the environment is too expensive. How do you respond to that?
Well, actually, I'm really glad you brought that up because, I mean, I've been involved in this work for about 20 years, and much of that time there's been messaging that I would call a false dichotomy that tends to pit environmental concerns versus economic gains. And my experience is that it's just not a true dichotomy. I mean, that when you look at the amount of work lost in our workforce due to illness, when you look at the days lost in school due to illness that can be attributed to some of these issues of air pollution, this is a big drag on our economy as well. I mean, there's a lot of angles to it, but it's, for example, to give you a sense of scale, we're interested in having curbside recycling all over the city. Right now, about 15% of the city has been in kind of a demonstration project mode. But the benefits of doing it citywide would not only allow us to stop burning everything that we're collecting as trash, it would aggregate the materials in a way that can feed small businesses and small manufacturing in the city, ways that those businesses will pay taxes, they'll employ people. It'll improve the air quality in the center city. And we know that we can implement this for somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million, which would give us all new equipment. You know, it would employ a lot of people. When you look at the size of the city's budget overall, $20 million is fairly small. I mean, for a regular person like you and I, $20 million is a lot of money. But when you're talking in terms of billions of dollars, it's not a lot of money given the potential leveraging of the benefit that can occur from that investment.
Mm-hmm. Guy Williams is president of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice. We've been talking about his recently released report, The Detroit Environmental Agenda. Guy Williams, thank you.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan native and MSU student Steve Price showed off his unique skill set recently on the TV show America's Got Talent. Steve builds Rube Goldberg-type machines, complicated contraptions that use dominoes and tubes and ping pong balls and other various materials to complete a simple task. On his appearance on the show, a single domino ultimately led to fireworks. The America's Got Talent judges were impressed.
My man Sprite, I love this kind of thing. The idea that you sit in a room and you create this, your mind's got to be something else. I love it, and congratulations on that working out. That was quite an accomplishment.
Thank you.
I liked it.
Howard Stern there. Price's invention took him all the way to the quarterfinals of the show. Steve Price, welcome to Current State.
Hi, thanks.
How did you get into making these extraordinary Rube Goldberg-type creations?
Well, it's hard to explain. I've always been interested in how things work and playing around with toys, and one day I just decided to combine a bunch of things together and see what I could do with it.
Yeah, and when was that? How old were you when you did that?
That was about 6 years ago, so I was like 13. And then over the years, they got more and more complex to the point where I could take it to America's Got Talent.
And finally, it just became too irresistible. You had to apply to get on the show.
Yeah.
Explain the process of making the machine that people saw on America's Got Talent. How does that unfold?
Well, for my quarterfinals performance, I wanted to do something big. Like the judges could say it could use more of a bang. So I wanted to come up with a way to light fireworks at the end.
Yeah.
So I spent like a day working on a theory to get a rig that would light up fireworks. And eventually I came up with the perfect rig. I made a few of them. I came up with a bunch of other ideas using various household objects, put everything together. I built it at home and then took it out to New York and rebuilt it on the stage of Radio City.
And it's crazy because for those of you who did not see it, this whole process is triggered by the proverbial tipping over of one domino. So the tipping over one domino by Heidi Klum ultimately led to fireworks. Now, how did the fireworks get lit ultimately? I mean, this is a long process, obviously, but in the end, how did they get lit?
So at the very end, I had some soccer balls roll off the edge of a table, and they landed on a lever type thing, and one end flips up, and on that end there are matches on the end, and then it was right up against the side of a box, and I cut out the side of a matchbox and glued it to that box, and when the lever flips up, the matches swipe and light the fuse above it.
Was that the most critical link in the chain? I mean, what was the most challenging link in this long chain of events?
Yeah, that was definitely the most difficult thing to come up with and get to work.
Lighting like a kitchen match or what was
just
it?
Just regular stick matches.
Regular stick, okay, amazing. This must take an awful lot of patience and time. How long did it take to create what people saw on America's Got Talent?
I spent 2 or 3 weeks working on that performance.
But how long did it took you 2 or 3 weeks to create the whole sequence?
To come up with everything and build it and test it and everything before I went to New York.
How are you constantly exploring new ways to create cause and effect is basically what we're talking about here.
Yeah, pretty much all day long I'm thinking of new ideas and then I'll go home later on and try something and see if I can get it to work.
How tense were you before the Heidi Klum actually tipped that domino over?
I actually wasn't too nervous. I was a lot more nervous for my first performance on the show. But then after that, I kind of got used to it. I got to stand on stage for a while and let my nerves calm before I started to.
We're talking with Steve Price, who's an MSU student. What are you studying, by the way?
Mechanical engineering.
This is, okay. So it's kind of like your major.
Yeah, it's exactly like it.
What do you want to? Is there an application for this? Can this be applied in some way?
Well, I'm not really sure where it's going to take me in the end, but I've gotten several opportunities after being on the show. Like there are technology companies that want me to build machines for certain events and a few other things like that.
Are there other people like you in the community who are just drawn to this kind of thing, who are also involved in creating devices like this?
Well, there are actually a few people on YouTube that I talk to a lot, and there are probably only like a handful of them in the whole United States. There was also another contestant on AGT a few years ago who did something kind of similar to what I do, chain reactions.
And how was ultimately your contraption evaluated on the show? Who judged it?
The judges, Howie Mandel, Howard Stern, Heidi Klum, and Mel B. In my audition, everyone loved it. I went straight through. Then I went to Vegas, and I got sent straight through to New York City. And then that quarterfinals performance, which I think was my best, two of the judges absolutely loved it, and then two of them were kind of iffy if it could be in like a live show.
What do your engineering professors make of this?
They're really excited. I've gotten a few opportunities to build machines for different things at Michigan State that I'm going to start pretty soon.
Is there any particular device you're working on right now that you're especially excited about? Are you trying to up the sophistication of what we saw on television, for example?
Well, right now I haven't started building my next machine, but I'm thinking on ideas about how I can make it more of a performance, adding more lights and music to the background rather than just the machine itself.
Steve Price is a mechanical engineering student at Michigan State. You saw him last week on America's Got Talent. Good luck, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow on Current State, we remember the 50th anniversary to the day of the March on Washington. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, to Aaron Young for engineering, and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State here on WKAR.